Let's kick off. It's a great pleasure for me to just briefly introduce Kat Smith. So Kat is a relatively recent grad from Westmont, where she double majored in economics and business and theology. So therefore, is supremely well qualified to lead us in a discussion around Jesus and the power of money in forms.
Thank you, Jim. Lovely to be here with all of you. Thank you for coming. I thought it was funny when Jim asked me as a recent postgrad to talk about money, because it's a new thing to be managing money. So I'm coming at it from a not super well-informed position, but in some ways, I guess, informed. Encounter always seems to be, but very much a discussion, so would love to hear from everybody your thoughts, and I have some guiding principles for us, but super free to interrupt or disagree or whatever you'd like. So when I'm thinking about what I kind of wanted to cover today and kind of where I wanted to go, I was thinking a lot about like money and consumerism. And so also for preface, Sydney Azzarello is leading part two of this in a couple weeks. And so we were kind of chatting and talking about like where this discussion might go. And she's going to be focusing a little bit more on like the money spending and like kind of the output of that. I really wanted to focus more on kind of the internal side of that and how consumerism and the way that we spend our money reflects kind of on our own state of our souls and in our relationships with each other and with God. So I have a couple kind of like consumerism pillars with some quotes and questions, and thought we would just kind of go through those and see where it takes us. So again, consumerism, money spending, I think in Christian conversations, there's often kind of the, where do we spend our money, like the charity and ministry side of it. And sometimes that is coupled with the like internal reflection on our souls, and sometimes not. And so really wanted to focus on that and how consumerism overlaps with soul care. So the first kind of like pillar thing that I want to talk about is how consumerism dulls or affects our sense of wonder. And so I have this quote from John O'Donohue that says, "Consumerism is the worship of the God of quantity, and advertising is its liturgy. Advertising is schooling in false longing." That like just really immediately grabbed my attention, and thinking about advertising being a liturgy in our lives, because I think that's something that's so like heavily ingrained. And talk about Jeff Bezos, like everywhere you look, there's Amazon, there's the 2-day Prime, there's, I mean, anything, not even Amazon related, like advertising has become such a liturgical part of our daily lives. And so I'm kind of curious to hear, one, people's thoughts on that, and also I think focusing on resistance to that. I was reading also this piece by Wendell Berry, and he talks about how wonder and delight is the greatest resistance to consumerism. And so just kind of wanted to like start with that, throw it out there. What do people think about advertising being a dulling sense of our wonder, / what are ways in which we live in resistance to that, whether it be delight or whatever else? I'll just throw that out there, see what people's thoughts are.
I never thought of wonder being a resistance or even an antidote to consumerism or to advertising. But I realize it is when it takes time to steep ourselves in wonder. And we're so bombarded with advertising, even if the stance that I'm not going to be on social media, watch TV, or publish periodicals, I could still quote you most of the little rhymes and ditties, or I can still recognize the Amazon label and the Nike swoosh, you know, all of those things are permeating us all the time. Whether we consciously adhere to it or welcome it, it's there. And to think about taking time to be in wonder, to absorb ourselves in the natural world, because it's taking time, it puts us in a different place, both physically and spiritually. It counters that.
Nice to have that. I feel that too, and that's kind of a new thought for me. But let's see, many years ago, like 40, we went and heard a speaker called Wilson Bryan Keys, and he wrote a book called Subliminal Seduction. And it was after The Hidden Persuaders, which was another book about hidden things in advertising. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really important for all of us to let ourselves become educated in how subliminal a lot of advertising is, you know, and realize that we may not even be aware of how we're becoming brainwashed to buy a certain product. And it's frightening to think about. And so it's good to, you know, try to teach our children, you know, to become aware of what's happening. And people are so eager to sell products, it's outrageous, or services, mm-hmm. you know. So we all need education in that, I think. So this is good that we're talking.
Mm-hmm. I've also found that, or you know, I went to Westmont and I felt like we talked a lot about consumerism. But then I've since left Westmont, but I've been in different spaces, and I've talked less about consumerism and more about buying things, right? Like, to me, it's just so fascinating. So we could spend like 1 week talking about this, but then every single day we're going to be like on our Amazon accounts being told we need this, we need that. So I guess as a pastor, I'm just trying to brainstorm more sustainable ways to resist consumerism, mm-hmm. because there's so many sustainable, powerful ways to enhance consumerism. Mm-hmm. And for me, like, whenever I'm on Amazon or something, if I'm tempted to buy something, oftentimes it's a sign I want to control something, to, like, control an unforeseen outcome, to control an experience I'm not used to. You know, like, I'm going on a trip. What do I need?
Yeah.
And I want to do a better job of seeing those connections between control and consumerism, because they're a tight linear line.
Yeah.
That seems really helpful and perceptive to me. If we feel almost a compulsion, a drive to buy something, why? What is happening? Just try to be sort of aware of that.
David French wrote a column about post-Super Bowl about the He Gets Us ad. And there was the political aspect of that. But he did an underlying question. He said, how do we feel about advertising Jesus?
Yeah.
Yeah. One of his sub-themes in the column was, how do we feel about advertising Jesus? Like putting an ad on for Jesus on TV.
After Super Bowl.
Yeah. Yeah. How do you feel about spending $14 million to say Jesus Gets Us to the public?
Well, I think we can all attest to the fact that marketing works. I don't know how I feel about the marketing of Jesus, but we're not, it's not big. Is that a consumptive market, or is that
we're selling ideas all the time.
Right? Yeah. I think it's interesting what Nikki said about, like, it. Consumerism being kind of a form of control, or like when we are consuming, it's like seeking control of like anywhere from like what, like in a utility sort of way, or like controlling our image. And like, I feel like that is like a huge thing for people if they're like shopping for clothes or whatever. It's like, it's all about this form of control and like curation. And so I think that it's interesting, like, the ideological marketing versus the product marketing, like, what forms of control are they both seeking to have, I guess, if that makes sense?
It seems all related. It's also similar. Mm-hmm. You know, I find that if I look at, oh, I have a new sweater, I'm going to look this up. And then you know how it is where you, that's not the end of it. The company keeps sending more and more, and it's like, you know, I don't have to do it. It felt a little uncomfortable to me because I wasn't sure of the source.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it felt like it was the wrong platform. I mean, I loved the idea. But I didn't feel like I was going, well, who sponsors that commercial, you know? And so it was a little uncomfortable, but I loved the message.
And the biggest audience it's ever had.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
I think I saw it.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt comfortable with that. I thought, wow, that's really neat. It might hit somebody at the right time. It didn't seem like it came from any particular bet. And that's what I liked about it.
Mm.
It was just, it was just God.
Mm.
And I'll never forget when my kids were little. No, this one is now over 50. But they were watching the little kids programs on TV. And there was the cutest little commercial about a horse. And what was really catching was the musical jingle that went with it.
Mm.
And she just thought she had to have that for Christmas. You know, so I took her down to the store. I went down to the store and I said, that's what it is. You know? And I may have taken her, I don't remember. But when I saw without the jingle, it was nothing. Yeah. It took all the air out of her. Or whistle.
Yeah.
So, but it was compelling because it was so cute and the jingle just ran in your head.
Mm.
And as adults, we have different jingles. But they know what we look at online and they program us to see the things that we're interested in.
Yeah.
Did she get the My Little Pony?
Was that it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you get it
for her?
Oh no.
Good.
No.
Stronger
person. No, I saw what a dead it was. I thought that's not gonna fly.
Go ahead.
Oh. Mrs. Rosenberg got her credit card stolen, but her husband's not doing anything about it because the thief is spending less than she was. I'm so poor, the pickpocket gave my wallet back. No, on the benefits of being poor, I mean, it's so freeing. You know, I'm litigation proof. I mean, they can't attach SSI, and I'm not worried about identity theft. I mean, financially, I don't even want to be me. And, you know, start spending money, you know, I'll go to a thrift store or something. I can't buy anything new. Everything, you know, there's, you know, I'm just used to not buying new things. So, and I don't have a computer. So I guess, in a way, because I'm tied in and I don't have money, I'm kind of free from this thing. I guess I still covet, but I just know for a fact I can't have it, so I'm kind of resigned to it.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a lot of scripture that's about and giving up, you know, releasing yourself, ourselves from material world, material goods.
If I had a lot of money, I think of things I bought. I don't, not that I don't fantasize on having something new, but I know I'm never going to have it. I do buy a lotto ticket once a month, though. I guess
you can't say never. Some of our thrift stores have new stuff in them.
When Nikki was talking about consumption and purchasing being related, having a direct linear correlation with control, I was thinking for myself sometimes it's yearning or satisfaction. The purchasing sometimes is more satisfying than the
happens. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what drives. I mean, I don't know exactly in my being what drives that.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's power.
Mm-hmm.
But you enjoy life, then you can give whatever is away. Enjoy it.
Yeah, but I don't know where the purchasing itself is. Maybe why is it more satisfying than something else?
Mm-hmm. I think I relate to that instant gratification aspect a lot because, like, I mean, I feel the same way when I buy something or, like, when there's a package at the front door, like, going and getting it and opening it, and then you pull it out, and it's like, okay, like, what do I do with this now? Like, I think I find myself having that thought a lot, and, yeah, I don't know. I guess it just strikes me in this conversation that, like, the time aspect and the, like, the novelty aspect, I guess, really – for me, maybe, or like, what the core of this conversation is, and I think just like seeing wonder as the antidote to those things is a really kind of striking image.
Yeah, I think that kind of like bleeds a little bit into the next kind of thing that I was thinking about when reading this was how consumerism affects our relationships, basically, and how those like. There's a line that talks about like how every day we have 1,000 manufactured wonders, and that like was really striking to me. And I think in thinking about relationships, some of the authors were drawing kind of a direct connection between this like this wanting to buy things, like this kind of like desire inside of us, and how that is fragmenting our like personal relationships, because everything, our relationships, we like look for, it's very like utilitarian almost, or you're like, it's transactional when you're constantly in this state of like, I want this thing to like help me, and how over time that fragments our personal relationships. And so curious kind of on that line of thought, what people think, is there, do you think there is a connection between consumerism and personal relationships? And if so, like, how does that show up to people?
I think one thing that I've thought about a lot in the past in relation to consumerism is just the idea that, like, to have is to be in the mind of, like, a marketer. And so it's like,
to have is to be.
So, like, we don't necessarily want the iPhone or the Lululemon for its own sake, but it's so much like, oh, if I have this, there's this association of, like, I'm going to be more fit, happier, like, all of this stuff. And I think thinking that way really turns your attention inward in a way that's pretty unhealthy, and I could see, and I think that is just, like, can be massively damaging to your relationship with other people when this, like, constant messaging of be this, through buying causes you to turn so inwardly, because then you're always thinking about what you want to be, and it's a block,
yeah,
to being able to think about the needs and the desires of others.
Like, marketing makes you kind of the center of your own universe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So narcissistic, even. It's always about me.
A lot of marketing, it's interesting that if it costs more, we want it because it means that we are about have a higher value.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And some things that just charge that because that's what makes it seem
I was thinking about in the Foundry years and years ago when Jim said that the opposite of addiction isn't sobriety, the opposite of addiction is relationship. You said something like that. And so that just reminds me of, if to some degree our consumerism is even in a small sense a form of addiction, then the opposite of that is relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. So if we're feeling lonely, if we're feeling longing, if we're feeling anxious, you know, yeah, buying something offers something, but what does sitting down with a friend and saying, I'm scared, like, can you hold that with me? And what would offer the more lasting? But yeah, that stuck with me when you said, but the opposite isn't sobriety, the opposite of addiction is relationship.
And I think on that point as well, we can expand the idea of consumerism to even social media. I mean, it can oftentimes become taking the place of relationships.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we do have a longing for meaning and purpose. And so haven't advertisers and marketers just tapped into that human need and said, this will make you feel better. Mm-hmm. This will make you important. And in our culture, it's easy to see that. So it's not like advertisers or consumerism created this. It's just tapped into it.
Money definitely affects relationships. As a retirement planner, I can tell you that I see more angst between couples and everything about finances.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of it it's under, there's other things happening underneath that, but there is a lot, I deal a lot with people that are, couples that are on different wavelengths about consumerism.
Mm-hmm.
And also people hiding things. I find more and more couples, one person may be buying things but not telling the other person. And so I'm having to deal with that a lot as well. I mean, it happens throughout life, but I can tell you it's a lot of relationship problems come from that.
My dad that sold cars for a living, and one time he said, I never have understood how someone can think only a certain car makes them more important. I mean, he just saw it as a utilitarian, and he's selling something to get you to work, and they're buying something that makes them feel more important.
But it's just like when I was in high school and the kids who wrote their names, stuck together.
You know, it's not anything.
In fact, and I don't think it's any different now. And it's like the car, Why do I think a certain car is always more snobby than the other people driving it? Because of the way they drive with more authority or whatever, I'm just cutting you in front of me,
So,
and a policeman won't chase
you. So we're recognizing the power and the seductiveness of buying stuff. What are some of the antidotes? I mean, Nikki has very helpfully said relationships. I think Carol said, pay attention to the jingle in your head. That's also very helpful. Are there any other helpful, practical things?
It seems to be also related to what Nikki said, and also relates maybe to addiction, of being conscious of when I'm like hungry, stressed, tired, like there's a fatigue. And then I'm going to comfort myself with a little, retail therapy. But that if I'm sleeping well, really like those kinds of things, it's the gap maybe is not as big a hole that I'm trying to.
And I was thinking, I had a friend who just came back from Mexico, and he was saying how happy, a place where they're not too materialistic, and a lot of other countries where there's not a lot of materialism. And I've heard a lot that people say how happy the people are there, because they look you in the eye, and they talk to you, they say hello. They care for each other, and they're just not focused on material goods. And yet you recognize that they have a happiness that we kind of long for. So being aware of that, thinking about that, helps me move away from materialism.
I think I was in Nairobi at the little bazaar there buying little animals and things, and my daughter wanted a leopard. And they said, a lion will do. I said, no, I need a leopard. But anyway, when I bought something, I gave her whatever amount of money. I was expecting 10 back. She said, oh, no, you don't need it. Buy one. Okay. And so I got something else. But she didn't nail me right. I had plenty of money. I don't need it. She needed it more than me. So I'm not sure Yeah, is being poor make you more satisfied,
yeah.
Content?
I think we should be really careful not to idealize poverty, because actually materialism is very alive and well in poor spaces around the world. And so I think reducing our consumption is a very helpful tool to maybe guide our attention away from consumerism and toward Jesus. But I don't think that we should be like, oh, poverty and not having a lot is the solution to all our problems, because for a lot of people it's actually a really big barrier for human flourishing. So
I agree with you totally, because people that are most impoverished, usually their social circle is, it's a totally different culture than what we have here, and our culture is lacking in that, in culture and caring for people more than it is lacking, I think, yet some other way.
I would maybe just suggest that that's a human-wide condition, though. I think it might express itself differently at different socioeconomic levels, but everybody, regardless of socioeconomic status, is yearning for something. That the easiest thing that we go to is wanting more materially, but it just can't fill it no matter where you are on the socioeconomic spectrum.
It's always better to have money. You get to live in nicer neighborhoods, you get to have better medicine, you get to have better schools. If you have a need, you can cover it, get to go to better colleges, you could have better everything. It's always better to have money for a quality of life, for longevity,
yes.
Everything.
It's true, money affords a lot of liberty, but I was thinking about two antidotes to consumerism. One is just stepping out in the natural world, just stepping outside. First of all, it relieves us from, unless we're carrying our cell phone, most of us do, but if we're not looking at what we might purchase, if we're outside, it's really hard to do that. The other is an odd thing, but when we consume, we also waste a tremendous amount. It's going to the Tahitlis landfill, going to where all of our trash goes to see what we collectively generate is repulsive, and it makes you kind of, I don't know, Susan, if you
well,
have
that part
right
of it, I think we've brought on the making one-use items. You know, you can't buy parts for anything anymore.
I see.
You know, the nature of our land.
I mean, you just go out to UCSB and look at those poppy fields right now. I mean, it's more beautiful than anything you could possibly buy. I mean, it's just beautiful out there right now. And I walk that trail out there quite a bit, and or the Innisbrook pathway up here, and all the flowers are out, and you just go up there and you go, wow. And you don't want it, you think this is like the best thing that could ever happen. I mean, it's beautiful. It's so green right now and everything.
Wasn't that what Dickens was trying to say in The Christmas Carol? And the future of Christmas, and they're piling all this stuff out in the street, and he's saying, "That's good stuff. What are they doing?" And but his, you know, looking ahead, his life's been gone, and it doesn't matter what he owned at that point. But it seemed really important to protect it at the time. So that Carol, the Christmas Carol, is an antidote to the times then, and still good for us now.
Yeah. I think another thing, we've kind of like touched on this, but to name it, I think that like consumerism as a force of isolation is like a big problem that we face. And I'm curious like what it looks like when we're picturing flourishing, thriving communities that are like integrated with self and with other, like how is consumerism playing a part or not playing a part in those, if that makes sense. And like, again, I think we've kind of like been getting at this, but consumerism being something that drives us apart from each other, and we become the center of our own universes. And what does that look like in the sense of a community? Like, how does consumerism act as an isolating force? Yeah, curious if anyone has thoughts on that.
David, you mentioned that. I mean, if you have more money, you find a better house. Or you go get out of the apartment and you get into a house, and mm-hmm. you're on your own lot, in your own little kingdom.
Yeah, I totally. This is just like kind of a personal anecdote. But so in The Great Divorce, I'm sure some of you might have read it. I actually wrote my like senior thesis on this, but he talks about scarcity, or hell is a place where there is no scarcity. And so I think that's kind of like a weird concept for us to think about, because it seems like it's like the opposite. But he describes this like neighborhood of hell, and it's people like moving farther and farther away from each other and accumulating more and more land and stuff. And anytime they don't want to like, anytime there's a clash with their neighbor or whatever, they can just move farther away until it becomes this like wasteland of people living far from each other and not being connected at all. And I think it's a really interesting idea, because kind of like what you were getting at, like, I don't think we should idealize not having enough resources for like basic human life. But I think that there's something interesting there of like how a lack of scarcity drives us away from each other, and how it can be an isolating force. And like what that, if you play it out down the line a few steps, what that would look like for our communities. Yeah, I don't know if you have thoughts on that.
There's an image of heaven and hell where this guy gets taken to hell to see it, and there's this huge, lovely banquet table with wonderful food, and everyone's sitting around, and the spoons are so long they can't feed themselves with it. So there's everything available, and so he takes them to heaven, same exact setting, except they're feeding each other.
Oh,
there you go.
That's pretty cool. I was just going to say, actually, that I think, Jim, to answer your question about some possible antidotes to consumerism, developing practices of generosity are huge. And I think, obviously, the scarcity that you're talking about generates a need for us to be generous with other people. And also, when I think when it's practiced well, generosity is a great opportunity to bring people together in a very deep relational way. So, I don't know, that's kind of my response and thoughts in the past few minutes.
What about response? Going on the side here, but responsible consumerism, where you think about, well, let's recycle and let's get this stuff, whatever the stuff is that I unwisely bought, say, clothes and there's some, get them to people who are going to use them and enjoy, get a lot of use out of them. Mm-hmm. Yeah, redistribute in a wise way.
And I would say that in order to implement, like, maybe we'll call those like corporately generous practices, we need to learn to become personally generous.
I think we need to learn to be needy. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm mostly thinking about working off of this. Like, when Jim and I first moved to the States, so it was unusual to be 50 and 60 and not own anything. Not as a worship, it's like, okay, well, how do we set up house? We have these things in Egypt. It wasn't worth shipping them here. And I remember, like, initially I was like, we're going to share from our neighbors. Like, why should every person on this block have a hedge trimmer? We need one. We need one for the street. Why does everybody on the block have a ladder? We won't get a ladder. We won't get a hedge trimmer. We now have two ladders. But this idea of what, like, I'm not sure. Like, as much as, like, being generous or not being generous, it's, like, not wanting to be needy and inconvenience. Mm-hmm. And to go knock on the neighbor's house and say, can I borrow your ladder?
Totally.
Are they using it when you want it?
Yeah. The kind of self-sufficiency. And I feel like it's very now, like, ingrained in us. And it's how, and I think some ways I hear about this, I'm not
social media savvy, of people who do create communities where you're within a certain radius and you can post, can I come pick up the ladder, or can I use this, or can I use that, and it's understood that that's, there's a loose kind of sharing. So, but it seems to me the obstacle to that is not the lack of generosity, but the not wanting to ask.
Mm-hmm.
And that willingness to ask is difficult.
I was talking to a friend recently who is very well-to-do. And he always tell my wife, said, we did nothing to earn all this. He said, but the joy of giving it away and hopefully doing it so well that the last check bounces. There's really been a joy to him, because what happened with them and with the company they started with other friends went beyond their dreams. But before he was a Christian, and that after becoming a Christian, that's just seeing, he told me he was a workaholic. And so he retired more out of being a workaholic than the fact that he wanted to not work, because he just needed to put the his time on the things. So his work now is actually giving away that wealth that he feels blessed by God, where before he thought he earned it and worked for it. Now he sees himself as having been given it to give away, which is a unique, would be nice if we all had that ability.
Well, he shouldn't sell himself short. He worked hard for that money.
Yeah. Well, he did. He did. Well, 24/7, he did.
Right.
He said, but the joy of giving it away is even more than, even though he loved the work, the joy of giving it away means more to him than the work did.
Yeah.
Which is a nice place to be.
Can I go back to what Kat was asking about how consumerism can affect our relationships? And I was thinking about in 1 Corinthians, when, and today's Communion Sunday, when Paul writes to the Corinthian church, because there's these problems that happen at communion, where the wealthy members have all this to eat, and they're kind of like hogging the bread and the drink, and like feasting on it, whereas the poorer members of the community then are left with nothing. And it was causing all these divisions. So I'm just going to read that, because I feel like it applies. So Paul's saying, now in the following instructions, I do not commend you, because when you come together, it is not for the better, but for the worse. For to begin with, when you come together as a church, I hear that there are divisions among you, and to some extent, I believe it. Indeed, there have to be factions among you, for only so will it become clear who among you are genuine. When you come together, it is not really to eat the Lord's Supper. For when the time comes to eat, each of you goes ahead with your own supper, and one goes hungry, and another becomes drunk. What? Do you not have homes to eat and drink in? Or do you show contempt for the church of God and humiliate those who have nothing? What should I say to you? Should I commend you? In this matter, I do not commend you. And so our approach to the Lord's Supper in our modern age is obviously different than what it was when Paul is talking about this. But again, I think it makes sense. Like, when we're in a community, we should know if other people are hungry. Like, we should be aware, and that shouldn't be a barrier for people to come and participate in communion. So anyways, I feel like Paul was really kind of calling people out for not thinking about how their consumption affects one another, and actually how their consumption was making, like, Christ's body and blood, it was making a mockery of it to some degree. So if we think of consumption affecting even the Lord's Supper, that is a helpful reminder for me.
But is humility kind of like a big answer to anything and everything? You know, humility basking that.
We've got a number of students here, recent grad. Is there any counsel or advice that those of us older and had to deal with financial issues, one might be willing to pass on to in this room?
Well, I often, when I go to buy something, quality is important if you're going to need it for a long time. If you're going to use it 3 times and you think you'll never use it again, maybe it's not the most important. And that goes with quality and everything. feel, especially close to some kind of very naked. If it's something that you're going to wear to a certain event that you're never going to wear again, for heaven's sake, you don't have to buy silk or wool.
Go to the secondhand store.
Yeah, that's what you do.
Bit different. Alice and I would fit envelopes and then didn't use the credit card. So if we put $30 in the envelope from that paycheck for food, that's how much we ate out. And when it was empty, we didn't go out. We didn't use the credit card. And so that started helping us get a control, manage our money and, you know, what'd you say?
Yeah, a budget. Like we decided ahead of time what we could afford.
I think it's, everybody's touched on this, be aware of how you're spending money. A lot of times people, I think, are just not aware of it. So you kind of go to the ATM, you take out $10 or $20 or $25, right? And it's gone, and you're not quite aware of where it's gone. And sometimes, I know when I first start working with people, they go, wow, we didn't know that's how we were spending our money. They'll say that to me. And so being aware of that, and I think you can be generous whether you have a lot of money or not. Generosity and wealth are not necessarily correlated, is what I'm also saying. Some of the most wealthy people I know give it all away. Some of the people that could give it away don't. And so that's a different concept to me than wealth or poverty. Generosity is different than that. Whether it's generosity of money, no, we talk about talent, generosity of whatever you want to give.
I would say be comfortable saving and giving away. Not necessarily money, but giving of what you can and be comfortable saving, even if it may mean that there are other things that go unaddressed or needed.
So I was going to ask, for some reason I thought we were going to be bashing Jeff Bezos. So what is it in him that made you use his name in this? That's obvious. I just, you know, maybe there's something else that I'm missing too. You know, I mean, I just, how does he bring up?
No, we are pretty obvious. You're not missing.
Yeah.
It's just he's a totem of, you know, as the founder of Amazon, the most natural way that many of us engage with consumerism. And also his name, fortunately, is alliterative with Jesus. Alliterative with Jesus.
He's a symbol.
What did that mean?
Sounds.
Alliterates sounds.
Jesus
and Jeff Bezos.
Jesus and Jeff Bezos. Yeah, I would say Jim. Jim gave me some creative freedom, and I took the freedom.
Yeah, it's good, because on Amazon, you can get whatever you
Exactly, want. Exactly. Yeah. I'm curious to kind of extend from Jim's question. I really appreciate all of the older people's lived experience and advice and money. I'm curious kind of from the other side of it for us young broke college or recently college graduates. I think that there's, well, maybe we don't have the lived experience of managing money. I think that like the idealism of it can be pretty valuable. And I think speaking for myself, like I recently graduated, I'm for kind of the first time like figuring out how to manage my work and salary and paying all my bills and such. So I'm kind of curious, like from the younger side of things, is there anything that you would offer as advice? Seems like a strong word to give money advice, but thoughts or reflections from kind of the position of not having the lived experience.
Pay off the credit card every month.
Caleb, I saw you nodding.
You're asking your peers.
I'm asking my peers. Yes.
Oh,
it's okay. So you know.
What sustains me? And that the idea of consumerism is putting that in our own hands. And that ultimately we need to be directing that towards the Lord. And so that doesn't mean, like, in a Christ-centered way, is the ethos of what I do.
Also, it's got to be, I mean, everything I read, it's got to be hard for you guys coming out of college. I mean, when I came out of college, it was a lot different. And I think we've just seen skyrocketing prices at everything. And sustaining your hope, I think, for the future has got to be hard. And I don't know if that's true or not, but everything I read is—it's a lot harder for you to come up to be on your own.
Yeah, I think that kind of idea is something that I feel like was always like, well, it was definitely like a part of my lived experience. But like in college, I think everyone's like, okay, like get ready, like once you graduate, you know, everything hits the fan, all that. But I think like for me, not to minimize like the challenge, because it is a challenge. Like we live in an expensive place and that's hard. And there are a lot of costs. And I would say like my natural disposition is that like money really stresses me out and costs really stress me out. And so when I graduated and like got my job, I started budgeting and I started budgeting from this place of like, I need to like be super conscious of every dollar that I'm spending and like put it all in the right category and make sure all my categories are the right percentage of my budget and all this. And after I did that for a few months, I realized that I was actually okay. And there was a lot more freedom than I thought there was in like what I could do with my money, and especially like freedom to give. And I think that idea of like, it doesn't really matter if you're rich or poor, like generosity is not, you know, not part of that equation necessarily. And so I think that was really, and it continues to be really impactful for me, and just realizing that I don't have to have it all. I don't have to make a ton of money. I can still experience freedom financially. And again, not to say like that's not everybody, but I think that's been a gift for me, and kind of just trusting that like, yes, wisdom is a part of it, and being smart and financially responsible is a part of it, but also just allowing room for freedom. And like I feel like one of the greatest gifts in just in the past several months is I feel like each month there's been someone or this thing that's going on that has approached me and said, like, we're trying to like fundraise for this thing. Are you willing to give a little bit of it? And I didn't budget for that thing that somebody's asking for, but I still like have been trying to allow myself the freedom to give to that and trust that it will all be okay, even if the percentages of the boxes don't, you know, line up exactly. So that's been something that I've been grateful for and realizing.
Yeah, I would say that is how I got freedom, is by doing the math.
Yeah.
For me, it sounds like you are very disciplined and you put priority.
Originally, I'm stressed. Trying to reframe.
I think to you on that note, like I'm graduating in 2 months and I'm taking out a massive loan to go to flight school, which was initially so scary. But you know, and it's going to take a lot of planning and careful, you know, budgeting to be financially stable through the process of paying that off. But yeah, and I was initially so anxious about it, but I had a great conversation with my dad where he was like, you know, the reality, Ben, is if you are not an idiot, you'll be okay through this. You'll be able to eat, you'll have housing. And there will be times where you'll have a lot less discretionary money, but don't be so don't hold so tightly to the whole money issue that you're letting it control you and push you into living in fear.
Mm-hmm.
And even though things are expensive, and we could complain about it all day long. And it does affect people in very real ways, and I don't want to minimize that, but I think sometimes, like for me, it's just been healthy to take a step back and be like, actually, I'm going to be okay.
Mm-hmm.
And there will be times where I won't get to do everything I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
But reality is not just sticking to a tightly controlled extension. I actually think it's, you have to take a step back because it's going to be okay.
Mm-hmm.
I remember my junior in college at the gas pump thinking, gas stays at 75 cents a gallon, well, my budget will be okay.
Here we are.
Filled up the Volkswagen for $2.50 a gallon.
It's painful. I know we're a little bit over time, so I just kind of wanted to wrap us up. I have this quote that I found that I thought was really beautiful by Barry Bryant. It says, "We are persuaded to see the universe not as a communion of subjects, but rather as a collection of objects. And we are tempted to suppose that we are entirely on our own because there is no grace or ultimate mercy within the depths of these things." So I feel like I kind of wanted to just wrap up with that as a sort of encouragement and like continued, hopefully we will all continue to be thinking about these things, but I think like the idea of in all of these objects or things or ideas that we're pursuing, there's no ultimate grace or mercy, like kind of reorients, at least for me, like I remember what I am seeking is like not being fulfilled by these things. And I think it's helpful to put that to words and that in the depths of like consumerism, marketing, whatever, all these things that we've covered, we're not going to find like the grace and mercy that maybe our souls are longing for. So yeah, hopefully that leads you all to continue thinking about these things. I don't know if Jim has any closing remarks.
Yeah, just to thank Kat very much for facilitating today. We are very enriched in Free Methodist Church in Santa Barbara to have a significant number of younger people, Gen Z students and recent graduates. We value them very much, and I think it behoves us to try to find avenues for encouraging leadership from our Gen Z participants. So thanks for showing us the way today, Kat. And we'd love it if in 2 Sundays at the same time for Encounter, you can come back, and we'll get Sydney Azzarello facilitate a conversation again around what the impact of materialism is upon us. Thanks.
Yeah.